The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show first broadcast by Fresh FM with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Hi, I'm Claire Williamson, and welcome to A Little Bit Booked on Fresh FM. Hopefully by now, I'm your favorite reader, writer, and editor on the radio waves, but if I'm not, well, there's always time. Just keep listening. Here with me today is author and restaurateur Erin Palmisano. Erin is originally from Maryland, but now she lives in Whakatu, Nelson with her partner and their two cats. In addition to owning and operating three restaurants that all of us, you know, here in Nelson know, love, and think are delicious, Erin is the author of The Secrets of the Little Greek Taverna, The Secrets of Maiden's Cove, and now The Secrets of the Lost Vineyard, which just launched on 24 February. Congratulations on your latest book, Erin, and thank you for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, and thank you. I appreciate that. It's very exciting to have the book out.
So now that you have the book out and presumably actually have some time to do reading yourself, what have you been reading recently, or what are you looking forward to reading?
Well, it's not entirely true, see, that I have a lot of time to read at the moment. It's funny, all writers are avid readers, and so I always have a book when I'm not actively writing or actively editing. And those are the times where I can't really read anything, simply because I'm just in my own story, in my own head. But I have had a little bit of a break. I got a little bit of a break around Christmas. Mm. And I have to say, I reread People We Meet on Vacation because it's coming out on Netflix. And it's my favorite Emily Henry book. I just absolutely love that. So that was really fun. And actually, a couple of days ago, a good friend of mine gave me Claire Keegan's Foster.
Oh, that's so good.
And I've read Small Things Like These, which I just loved. And you know, when somebody just, you walk in a room and somebody looks at you and they just hand you a book, and it's that look that just says, okay, I'll go home and read it right now. And I love her books. They're more experiences of reading. Her books are poetry, and the words and the lines that you find just wash over you. And so I finished that last night. So that was like,
have you seen the movie yet?
Small Things? No.
Is it good? No, I haven't either.
I've heard it's really, really good. I love Cillian Murphy. But yeah, I remember when I saw the previews for this film, and I was like, something about this seems really familiar. Mm. Why is that? And then I remembered reading Small Things Like These, which was also a gift from my neighbor, and it was handed to me in the same type of way.
I feel like that would make me feel very seen.
Yeah.
If someone just walked up to me and was like, did an eye scan up and down and went, this is your book.
Exactly. It's exactly how it makes you feel. And what's really funny about that is that my friend who gave me this book a couple of days ago, as I was reading, I realized it was only two, I think, but she underlines special lines. And they're beautiful. And, you know, sometimes you get this Claire Keegan line that just like washes over you. And it was like I was seen and then I saw her. And it was just this whole like lovely sort of reading experience, which I love the way that books can bring us together like that.
What kind of person would you hand The Secrets of the Lost Vineyard to?
Somebody who needed to be cheered up that day, probably. Like somebody who's just like, I just want to escape the world for a day and just feel a little bit happy and escape. That's probably the person that I would give that book to.
So we'll try and keep most of today major spoiler free.
Okay.
For people who haven't yet had a chance to pick up and read The Secrets of the Lost Vineyard yet. But premise, we have Victoria Bishop, who's suddenly discovered she's inherited a vineyard in Mendoza, Argentina. And this sounds wonderful and awesome, except she discovers that this vineyard actually hasn't produced any grapes in years. And so the book is this, you know, her trying to solve this mystery and win over the eclectic locals in this small, tight-knit town and figure out what she wants to do with her life, and clearly has a lot on her plate. And I will put out into the universe that if anyone wants to gift me a traditional Japanese coffee shop, my heart, my arms, my palate are open to this experience.
I will keep that noted.
Please do. So what I personally empathized a lot with in Victoria was this concept of like she had one particular dream for a very, very long time. But then there's this big life pivot that happens to her, and she has to kind of pause and reset and kind of consider new possibilities in her life. And I was wondering if that's an experience you've ever had.
I've definitely had experiences where I've had a lot of really big life dreams.
Mm.
And big life dreams are funny things because they are motivating and inspiring and they set us on this amazing journey. But they can also be all-encompassing. And I've been really, really lucky in my life that all of the really, really big pivotal changes that I've made have been choices.
Mm.
And not everybody has that. And the characters in all three of my books have a pivotal moment, something very particular. And it's always something that I feel needs to be talked about a little bit and is an important topic that sort of forces them to change and reevaluate when they're feeling. I mean, Victoria is basically at the lowest she can possibly go. And to these secrets books, I feel like, and, you know, they're about a lot of things, but all of them are really, I feel like at the end of the day, they're about healing and hope. And all the characters are sort of going through this transition of healing, usually in a very fun, sometimes funny way of filled with friendship and laughter and a destination, of course, and learning that there is a new life for you to start when you've finished this particular journey.
Yeah, because change is really scary. And sometimes you can feel like you know, when you've had your heart set on something for so long, it kind of is like almost like you've got blinders on.
Oh,
and you can't see the other opportunities that are out there for you.
Even if nothing bad has ever happened to change that. I mean, I've had really big life dreams that I've followed and I've chased. And I'm so glad I did. But I sat in them for a lot longer than I really wanted to, because dreams can make us sometimes feel a little bit trapped. Like, well, no, I said I was going to do this. This is my dream. It sometimes can become your entire sense of purpose and your sense of meaning and who you think you are and how you're defined in the world is by your dream. And unfortunately, a lot of times a dream is something that hasn't yet come to fruition. So, yeah, I don't know if that makes sense, but...
No, I think that makes sense. And I think there's a lot to be said for a literal spatial shift. And so very quickly in the book, we have Victoria uprooting herself from the States and heading down to Mendoza, Argentina, which was not a place that I personally knew existed. So I did Google Maps and I was like, oh, yeah, cool. This is real. Got a little bit of a sense of geography. And so then I'm like, have you traveled there, spent much time there, or is this all also dream desktop research?
No, I have. So I'm a huge traveler. And when I started writing my first book, I was actually sitting down to write a travel memoir of all these experiences and blogs and emails and stuff I'd had together, because I've traveled all around. And it was my passion. Of course, lockdown was just a very weird time to be looking at this normal life that you had and being like, when will things ever be normal? It was just so surreal. And it was day one of like that, you know, level four lockdown or whatever. So I decided, you know, to write fiction specifically instead. But I was going through all of my travel destinations and that was sort of the fun part. And I was like, I could be like a destination writer, like fiction writer and do some really fun things in places that I've been, in places that I've loved. So every place that I will ever write about will be somewhere that I have been and loved. Argentina had a very special place in my heart. I probably spent my 2.5 months there.
Okay.
On a maybe 6-month backpacking trip. Zigzagged a little through Chile. But yeah, so most of my quote unquote research was really delving back into some photos and some memories. And it was cool because my partner, Dan, actually came to meet me for the Mendoza and Buenos Aires part. So, you know, there was a lot of yelling across the room. What was that thing that we ate when we went there? And so sort of really reminisce about like some food, mostly food.
The best travel memories are always food.
They're always food. Yeah. All my pictures were food. I was like, I don't have any pictures of anything else. So, yeah, I loved everything about it. I love the culture. I love the language. I love the Spanish language. The terrain was so beautiful. It's vast, very vast. And the food and wine, of course. So it came pretty simultaneously, choosing the Mendoza region of Argentina and a cursed vineyard. I just thought that there would be a lot that could go, a lot to play with there.
Mm.
And there really was in the end, like way more than I expected. I did have to do some research, of course, because I haven't been there for over 10 years.
Mm.
But I used a lot of Google Earth this time, where I would just like zoom in more to get a sense of geography. And like, you know, you see something in your head, but you're on a bus and it's like, okay. But yeah, there was a lot of going down memory lane.
What was it like when you were there backpacking?
It was one of my favorite It was one of my favorite trips. I started in Argentina, stayed in hostels, rode buses. I sort of did Argentina, Chile, sort of zigzagged up to the top. And then I did 2 months in Brazil and then Colombia and then down into Peru. And yeah, it was at that time of my life, that was the dream. It was every day you sort of wake up and, you go when you're ready and you stay when you want. And it's a lot of freedom and a lot of awesome places and experiences that will stay with me for the rest of my life. So yeah, it's a great place. You should go.
South America is one place I have not been yet.
Yeah.
What was the best thing you ate? I'm making you choose.
It would have to be the steak. There's so many different cuts and we got a cut of steak every day. Tried every single different one. They're very, very interesting with their cooking there, though. You say rare or medium rare, and you never know what you're really going to get. It could be anywhere from like blue to well done. You're just like, oh, but the quality is just so amazing. But there was also a very, very cool thing that we did, which is actually what I based a scene on in this book, is we went to this estancia in Las Pampas, which there's horses and stuff, and you just hang out for a couple of days, and they make you this barbecue, and they did the traditional lamb, like hanging up the lamb barbecue outside, and then you just have salads, and it's just super, super cruising. It was in like a family home, so it was really authentic. So probably not like the tastiest food, but probably that was probably the best like food experience. But yeah, the steak and Malbec. Ugh. It's one of those things where it's just like, oh, that sounds boring because everybody says that. It's like, that's because it is that good. Yeah.
That sounds delicious.
Not if you're a vegetarian. If you're a vegetarian, go for the provoletta. Also delicious.
So as a restaurateur yourself, what skills do you find that you take from your kind of day-to-day workflow that you bring into your writing, whether that's how you practice the craft or how you go about building character? I imagine there's a lot of great observation of people and like different pivotal moments in their life when they, walk into your restaurant.
Yeah, no, it's funny. My process is definitely growing and changing as well as I go along. So my first book, for Little Greek Taverna, I actually sat down to write like a destination romance, like a hot destination romance. And that one has like, that's just like, Jory's like all me in so many ways. Not her personality or her past, but I took that whole travel memoir thing and just went, plonk, you get all my experiences so I can live vicariously through you. So all of the stuff she talks about in that book about even getting like robbed by a baboon are like things that happened to me.
Oh, fun.
In my travels. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It was a good time. Had by all, especially the baboon. Who stole my backpack?
Did you get it back?
Yes, but that's a long story for after the recording. Anyway, I've lost my train of thought. But what I brought into that particular book was my world of travel experiences. And then I got writer's block really badly about 20,000 words in.
That sucks.
It does. I mean, that's one of the things about, I was at my lunch the other day, I was talking about the first time I learned the word pantser as a writer. And that's what I am. I go into a book without really having a destination and don't really know where I'm going. I have a few things in place. And so that book, but you do end up getting stuck occasionally. Usually for me, that's where the magic happens because you have to find something. And in my first book, that something was a recipe. Dan is the chef and working in the restaurants. And then it just all really, the magical realism came into it and it all came to life. And the restaurant and the food aspect was something I was like, why didn't I think about writing about this before? It's what I do for a living. And then in the second book, it really got developed because she became my character was a restaurant owner, inherited a restaurant of her father's. And that was really fun to bring like lots of levels of like my everyday work life into that. But the funny thing is I wrote those books back to back before I got published. So they were very solo journeys of me finding my process of writing and how much of myself will go into every character. By the time I got to this novel, Lost Vineyard, I had edited my first book. So I was writing in a very different way. I knew where the book sort of had to go. I knew sort of the character arcs a little bit better. There's not much of me in this one. There's definitely not a lot of restaurant stuff in particular in this book, but there are a lot of, I still think I get inspired by people's stories and people's characters. And of course, the travel experiences, obviously. But it was really fun. I felt like this was my first novel that was, I wrote, had my editor in my head, which is usually a lot of, you're an editor as
yeah,
well.
Yeah.
So
I wouldn't be offended if you were like, mute. mute to that voice.
No, I've worked with the same copy editor for all three books, but it was really funny by this one. I remembered my first book. It was like 3 pages, and it was just like, oh, just be careful. Your characters can sometimes, you can just say, he said, she said. You don't have to say, and then he laughed. And I was like, okay. And then like by like page 5, she was just like, all she did was highlight them all so that I would see them on the page, not say anything. And then like 2 pages later, she just wrote, your characters laugh a lot, full stop. Not impressed. So most of my editing now with her in my head goes backspace, said. So that's quite fun. But it was, I've started to really hone my sort of creative process of how I write. And that's been really fun because this was like the first book I felt like I wrote that's really, it's just a story. It's a story that I love, but there's not so much of me personally in there. And I think that happens when you evolve as a writer. I think you always start writing what you know a little bit more. But I always like to give shout outs just in case. Mm.
Was it painful to write a main character, and this isn't really a spoiler, who almost literally is pathologically incapable of cooking?
That was one of the most fun parts. I'm really not a good cook. I've become a pretty good cook.
Mm. Not a natural cook, maybe.
I have 5 things that I cook that rotate into the weekly, and 3 of them are tacos, just with different fillings.
Great. No complaints.
But I kind of wanted to go opposite of, you know, Cressida in the first book and opposite of the food and go like this person that just loves food so much and is just like burning the house down. And it's kind of one of those things when you go, I love writing comedy. So whenever I get to write some comedic moments, I really run with that. And that was just one. There are a couple comedic people in the book. The parents, not to give any spoilers away, were really fun. And yeah, her abominable cooking was just like, it just got more and more fun. It was like taking a joke just went too far. But it was, that was really fun.
I appreciated her ongoing efforts as someone who is also not a natural cook. But I will deeply admit that it made me feel better about myself because I was like, okay, at least I would have known to like take the chicken out of the bag. You know, it would have been okay. I would be all right.
I was like, that's so something I would have done. I haven't done it, I promise.
That's good.
But yeah.
So one of the, and we've kind of touched on this a little bit when we're talking about people addressing pivotal changes in their lives and the support systems that underpin their ability to do that. But one of the things I really loved about this book was all the different ways you explore love. Mm. And there's you know, the romantic kind of love. There's familial love in many different ways because Victoria is adopted. And then there's almost the strongest form of love in this book was the friendship, like ride or die friendship bonds, you know, throughout generations.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd love to know how you went about kind of like differentiating those feelings and winding them all together.
This was it was such a fun book to write because of all of those things. Mm. The multi-generational part of the grandmother who's passed away, Luce, and her 4 friends growing up came about the exact same way that the recipe did in Greek Taverna, total writer's block. Mm-hmm. And it was actually an exercise that I was doing to get myself out of my head, a first person type of thing. You know, why is the vineyard curse? Can you please tell me? And instead she was like, let me just tell you my whole life story. And I know exactly where to start. And I know it sounds silly saying it like that, but because I don't really know my characters that well, I really do feel like they sort of come through and introduce themselves to me, which is probably why I can't read as much because I'm like, it's the same part of my brain.
You've got all
these
people in your head.
I'm like, yeah, exactly. I'm like, where are you? What are you doing? I laugh when they laugh. And Dan's like, that's you. And I'm like, not really. But she's really funny tonight. But that friendship really, really started to alter things for the book because there's, you know, the modern story going on. And then we're finding out about these women who were also friends. And then you have this modern friendship that's sort of a frenemies type of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. Which was really fun to write because I haven't written that before. Female friendship is always where I write my strongest and family. And I recognize that that is because I'm an incredibly lucky person. And I have a lot of amazing, inspiring people in my life that make that the thing that I unintentionally write about the most. The parents, as I said, I realized really early on that that first scene where she goes back and she sees her parents before she goes down, it's one of those scenes, again, as a writer and an editor, there aren't many scenes that remain untouched from like first draft to the end, and that's one of them. They just came so naturally to me, but it also was really, it made me realize that this is why she's going to get through this, is because she's having the worst year of her life.
Mm.
But she's grown up with these people that have unconditionally loved her, even though they're her adoptive parents and each other. And that sort of support will give her the base to be strong. And I knew that sort of before she even left. I was like, you're going to be okay, girl. Like, you got your parents. Every time I could get them in, like, I'd be like, maybe we can create a FaceTime call so I can see them again because they're just so much fun. But yeah, it was the four women and their friendship. And as soon as I realized how strong that was and started bonding that to the land and then bringing that into the modern story, I realized that these friendships and this family that all started becoming connected by this land, and all of a sudden it was like all this generational love. And yeah, the story started to write itself, and it was, it definitely has the most, I think, most themes of love, different types of love than my other books. And the romantic love, I always love a good romantic love. In my Secrets books, I do think that they have come sort of more at the second story, not mm-hmm. sort of the main story. We'll see next. I'd like to write a nice hot romance.
Are you, is Emily Henry your favorite romance writer?
I reckon she is now. Yeah. I'm trying to think. I do. I just love a good rom-com. I think they're just so much fun. But yeah, Emily Henry was one that was introduced to me. A friend of mine was just like, and I'd never read one before, which is funny because I watch heaps of rom-coms. Mm. I'd read romances and, you know, all that, but at very eclectic taste, but never like a quippy rom-com. And my friend said, no, you're going to love this book. And I was like, read the book, and I was just like,
Same friend who handed you the other book?
No, different friends. I got a lot of girlfriends. That's why I probably write a lot about them. Different friend. All readers, of course. No, this particular friend actually lives in New Orleans, and they filmed part of the Netflix movie there, and she was working it.
Oh, cool.
And that's like her favorite book, too, so that was really neat. But yeah, I would say if there's an Emily Henry coming out, Michaela will have it in the back for me before it goes on the shelves.
That's important.
Same day, of course, because I can't get it early. But
backing up a little bit, just kind of because I really want to, I do love the friendship bit a lot, and I did really want to talk about it. What for you is the grounding of a really strong friendship, and kind of how did you try to bring that out?
That's a really good question. It's a really good question that feels kind of impossible to answer. In some ways, it's like, you know, when you meet a person that, like, you just connect with. I mean, it could be a, you know, romantic love or a friend who's, you know. But, you know, you meet and you just finish each other's sentences and you read the same books and there's just this connection there where you're just like, I see you. You said that earlier. You feel seen and you feel heard. And you see that person. And I think it's just a really, I don't think it can be forced.
Mm.
I think it's a really, really natural connection. And it can grow. And I do. I have quite a few of those relationships in my life. And the reason that I write, you know, these healing journeys that are involved so much with, you know, the support and bond of these female friendships is because I think that's how we do get through these things. The worst times of my life can turn into a huge laugh fest if I'm Skyping two of them, you know, at the same time, and we're just reminiscing. And the interesting thing, I think, about what I try to convey is that I don't try to convey it. It just is there, mostly in the dialogue, because as soon as I have two girls together, like two friends together or frenemies, on the page, that sort of companionship, that thing just starts going. The dialogue just really starts going. I see things quite cinematically. So like watching a scene,
all of your books pass the Bechdel test, which is great.
What's that?
I'm going to paraphrase it. It's like, this test where it's like, does a work, could be a movie or a play or a book or something, have at least two female characters? do those female characters talk to each other? And do they talk to each other about something other than a man?
Okay.
And that's like, that's amazing how many pieces of, yes, literature or cinema fail that kind of.
Really?
Feels like a very basic.
Is there
test.
One that says, does this book have so many female characters that never shut up about anything? Because that mine might be in that. They're very talkative. They're very, very chatty.
I don't think there's one at quite that level. But, you know, you can safely say tick all of your books past that.
Oh, thank you. Well, that's great. I think that says something. You know, it was really funny. I didn't really realize until I was doing the acknowledgments of my first book, writing them, which was years later, that I was like, all these people I have to thank. I've become a writer of female friendship. How did that happen? It was just so unintentional, but it was, it's definitely where I feel my most natural.
And then the magical realism, which comes through again. Like, there's this thread through all of your books about this. And, you know, there's always a little bit of a question mark over it. Is this, you know, are they all just seeing things? Is this all just coincidence? Or is this actually happening? How do you stop yourself from going too far and making it too, you know, obvious?
I think I made a really active decision. I love magical realism, and I have a lot of, and there's a lot of levels of it as well. Different writers have chosen to go different ways. I think what I loved the most about it, what first hooked me in to that particular genre, was that it felt like it could be real. And how do you do that? And so I sort of created my own set of rules for myself that if you're going to ask your readers to suspend belief, and it's not complete magical realism either, it's more like threads sort of simmers through. If I'm going to do that and want them to believe that that's really happening, then the rest of the book has to be grounded fully in reality, which is why you always have a happy ending, but not a magical miracle happy ending. Because the rest of my book should be grounded in reality. And I think that's, for me, where those type of books get really fun, is that everything else is so real that you can just believe for a second, well, but if it's happening in the real world, maybe it really happened. You know what I mean? It's so subtle. There's some of them have gone less subtle than others. And sometimes I do like to sort of push the boundary a little, but with it sort of reined in a little, where you sort of go, well. And I do have editors that help me with that, obviously. My editor, the actual, you know what? I'm just going to scratch all that I just said. Editors. No. But they do. They are the ones that come in and just go, little too far to the right, little too far to the left, rein this in, add this. And they've been really great at saying something, you know, like, keep this, but make her question her own sanity type of thing. And those, and again, the more I have written, the easier it is to do it myself before we actually get to that place. But I do. I've loved writing these books in this genre. It's been very fun.
So one thing that you did say is, you know, there's this thread of magical realism, but there isn't a magical happy ending. And this is the one spoiler that I wanted to bring up. So if people don't want to be spoiled, I'm gonna skip a few minutes ahead. Which is that there is this, you know, I'm doing air quotes for people who can't see me, magical cursed vineyard question mark. But it doesn't, you know, if we're just kind of assuming the magic is real, it doesn't magically fix Victoria's infertility at the at the end of the book. You know, she's gone through this whole journey about wanting to find a family and wanting to nurture something and wanting to be a mother, and your book explores a lot of what that can mean. And one thing I was kind of worried about is that at the end, the the healing of the vineyard would also kind of magically like heal Victoria literally. And I was kind of like, no, don't do that. And you didn't. And I was really happy. So I would love to know kind of if you thought about doing that and then kind of decided, no, that's not right for this story.
No. Obviously, the thought was there, but the thought was there as a hard no from me from the beginning. But I almost did like putting little hints in that she might hope for that, which is a little bit mean, actually. very, very, very occasionally in life, miracles do happen. But that's not the case for Victoria's issue. And again, that's being steeped in reality. And my books being about healing and hope, that it was always very, very intentional that she just had to simply create a new life, accepting those things that she could not change and finding joy, because that's how most of us have to do it, you know? And I didn't want to also disservice anybody who's been through that by, you know,
magicking it away.
Magicking. Yeah, yeah, exactly. It was always something that somebody who wrote that book who wasn't me could have gone one way or the other. And I was always aware of it through the course of writing it, especially because it happened quite symbiotically, but it wasn't actually a plan that her infertility and the curse of the vineyard, that they started sort of healing each other, in that they were she and her land were going through the same thing. No, that's too much of a giveaway. Yeah. I'm also happy that with the way that ended. She does have her happy ending, 100%. But it's not a miracle. Mm. Yeah.
And so looking ahead for you, now that you've written 3 Secrets of books, how do you see yourself evolving for your next book?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so excited. I just never stop writing now. I mean, the more I write, so I'm working on book 5 and editing book 4 already. So, which is why I've been so busy working. It was funny. I had like a little bit of a break after a really, really like hardcore edit. And the first day I was like, it's 5:00. I can maybe do something else. I was just like, oh, I'm working on book 5. I can go back to that. So I'm getting a little bit addicted to the process, I think. But this book was always going to be the last of the Secrets books, and it's been such a joy to write in this genre. And I wouldn't stray too much at all, because I like writing happy, fun, funny things. Absolutely. And I love all of the – I don't think I'll ever be able to shed the themes of, you know, the friendships and, you know, those – food will always find some place in my books, even if somebody's just eating out. And the destination will always be something. But I just decided with my publisher, obviously, to sort of go back to what I was originally doing with Little Greek Taverna, as like just a hot destination romance and quippy sort of rom-com style, which is I'm writing in the first person for my next books, which is so much fun. And I do think, though, that like writing in the same genre for at least 3 books is really important, because, you know, you've got parameters within your genre, and it's having those parameters is actually great, because you've got so much, I do at least, freedom, like flexibility and creativity within the confines of those. But yeah, so without saying too much, because it's in very early stages, that's just a really, really fun. And I don't feel like it's like a jump in a totally different direction, more like a sidestep. So just doesn't really have the magic, but it does have a lot of other aspects from my other books. So hopefully all of my Secrets readers will come along for the next ride.
How exciting.
Yeah, it's fun. Yeah.
And with that to look forward to, hopefully soon, I have a few bookmarks to wrap us up for today's episode. One is that the finalists for the Auckland New Zealand Book Awards 2026 have just been announced in the four main categories. So congratulations to everyone who's been nominated from that. And those winners will be announced on 13 May at the Auckland Writers Festival. And there'll be a little bit of a, there'll be a mini deep dive into some of the shortlist from me probably early next month. And then entries also opened earlier this week for the 2026 Aotearoa New Zealand Book Industry Awards. And there's six categories to celebrate all the different people behind books. So that's the publishers, the booksellers, the writers, the editors. We need some love too. So you can nominate yourself or someone you admire online. And that is it for today. So you can find me online as at Accidental Tokyoite. You can follow Erin as at author Erin Palmisano. And her latest book, Secrets of the Lost Vineyard, is available now wherever fine books are sold, including here in Nelson at Paper Plus, which has a really fabulously cool, like, whole book display with giant bottles and vines.
That's my champagne bottle. Heck yeah.
Which has a very elaborate display, but also Page and Blackmore. So thank you, Erin.
Thank you
for coming on to talk with me today. This was really great.
Oh, thank you. I've had a fantastic time. Thank you so much.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.